Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments Podcast. Tune in to your leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, Associate Editorial Director with Neurology Live. In this episode, we're going to discuss the recent approval of Alzheimer's disease treatment, lecanemab. Although the prospect of new treatment options for patients with AD has certainly been a welcomed one along the way, it has also come with speculation, scrutiny, and scuttlebutt. This was the case in 2021 for aducanumab, and for lecanemab, it has been no different. Today, we'll summarize the news that has occurred over the last month since lecanemab was approved, and you'll hear perspectives from two experts in neurology clinical care. Anton P. Thorstensen, the William B. and Sheila Konar Professor of Psychiatry, Neurology, Neuroscience, and Medicine, and the Director of the Alzheimer's Disease Care Research and Education Program at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry, and Alberto Espe, the Division Director and Research Endowed Chair of the James J. and Joan A. Gardner Family Center for Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders, and a Professor of Clinical Neurology and Rehabilitation Medicine at the University of Cincinnati. Let's dive in. On Thursday, July 6, 6 months after it earned an accelerated approval nod, the FDA approved lecanemab, marketed as Leqembi by Eisai, for the treatment of patients with early-stage Alzheimer's disease. It was the second such therapy approved for this indication since 2021, but the first to earn traditional approval. The FDA's decision to approve the humanized IgG1 monoclonal antibody, which binds with high affinity to amyloid beta soluble protofills, was supported by data from the Phase 3 Clarity AD trial, which acted as a confirmatory study for the original tentative approval. Its data, now published in the New England Journal of Medicine, Clarity included 1,795 patients with evidence of amyloid on PET or cerebrospinal fluid who were followed for an 18-month treatment period. At the conclusion of the analysis of Clarity AD, lecanemab met its primary endpoint of change in clinical dementia rating sum of boxes score, with treated patients demonstrating a statistically significant reduction in decline compared with placebo. How this approval's downstream effects will be displayed in the field of neurology are yet to be determined. However, there are differing opinions on what may occur. The biggest point of contention around lecanemab appears to stem, at least in part, from this main finding. Here's Dr. Alberto Espe, who's been a vocal critic of these data, with more on this.
It is going to likely provide a great deal of support for the for additional research into the amyloid hypothesis. The amyloid hypothesis a very strong second wind. Just when we thought that we had all the evidence we needed to reject this hypothesis, we have now a position where we're accepting what some might refer to as something better than nothing. And as I've alluded in prior sessions, this is a worse than nothing approach to Alzheimer's. Lecanemab and more recently donanemab are exceptions to the rule only because they have such large numbers of patients that they have enrolled into their studies that the very, very small difference that appears in favor of the drug reaches statistical significance, but in no way that difference is meaningful. In fact, in the prior phase of development, there was the same magnitude of benefit, but that was a study done on 850 individuals. Mm-hmm. So the company decided for the phase three to, knowing that that was the best they can do, to double the sample size. And that's why we have nearly 1,800 people in this study. And so I think in answer to your question is we've been unable to look at the data as a whole and say this, we're chasing the tail. Mm-hmm. And so what this decision is doing is going to give a lot of strength to this idea. For patients, though, there is very little, if anything, that they could benefit from this. In fact, there is much more to be harmed by this treatment than there is any potential benefits from it. And that's not even talking about the healthcare system that would be a mess if only 10% of individuals with Alzheimer's are going to be treated with this condition, with this medication. So we're seeing the data for what we want the data to tell us. I have created an infographic of the data for people to look at and be able to determine for themselves. It's a bit of a visual guide to the consumer, and I'm happy to share that with you if you wish to include it in your piece. I think it's important when you see the data, and don't make any of it, just seeing the data in a visual fashion, just one slide, it's all the data. I think you can tell that there is a lot more harm to be inflicted by this medication rather than any benefits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's just been a lot of inconsistencies in terms of patient to patient, which is kind of, I guess the whole general idea is that obviously if the larger majority of patients aren't really receiving the benefit, then it's kind of hard to tell what the benefit is.
And let's also specify that by benefit, we don't mean improvement. Mm-hmm. No one improved. And that's critical because I think people have heard the term 27% improvement. It's neither 27% nor it is an improvement. So essentially everybody declined, everyone worsened. Mm-hmm. The thought is that the rate of worsening mm-hmm. of those in the treated arm was less than the rate of worsening in people in placebo. And that is true after 18 months of biweekly infusions, but that difference actually amounts to 9% of a change and actually is the amount 2.5% of the scale from which it comes. I recognize that's probably not the most fair comparison, but 27% is not the right number. It's 9% difference. And this is why it's important to see this. And it's a 9% difference between groups. Individuals will not be able to tell the difference. So we have to, as clinicians, instruct them that they are going to be given a medication on the hope that they will slow their decline, not to benefit. In fact, we have to tell them, don't look for benefits or improvements because there won't be any. You just have to trust me, somebody like me, not me, but somebody like me, we have to say to a patient given this medication, trust me, this is going to be somehow a slower decline. And we just cross our fingers and nothing bad happens to you. That latter hope is more theoretical than, or more practical than theoretical, because there is a measure called the number needed to harm. That's how many people you need to treat to harm one. The number is 3. Out of three people given this, one gets harmed in some way or another. There is another metric called the number needed to treat, NNT. And this is how many people do we need to treat to make one better? Mm-hmm. We don't know what the number is because no one responded in what is necessary for a responder rate. So what we're dealing with in terms of a positive study is a statistically significant difference between the groups that patients cannot tell, but because the study was so large enough, puny differences somehow became significant at a statistical level. And how much is that worth? That is what patients will have to ask themselves. Doctors will have to also ask themselves as they offer this to their patients. And we all, as doctors, need to know when doing nothing is better than doing something. Doing something is not always the best thing. And doing something with lecanemab is not going to be a net benefit. It's going to be, at best, futile, and at worst, actually quite harmful.
But the downstream effects of this approval can't all be negative, and many have shown support of the FDA's decision to approve the drug. However, As was the case with aducanumab 2 years ago, additional concerns have arisen about the risk of amyloid-related imaging abnormalities, also known as ARIA. Here's Dr. Anton Thorstensen, who's an investigator in lecanemab's trial, with his perspective.
So, I've had the good luck of actually participating both in the phase 2 and phase 3 development of lecanemab. So, basically, it's been many years in the making. And what I think is really important is that this is the first time that we really have undisputable evidence that targeting amyloid, in this situation, protofibrils and amyloid plaques, if done in a meaningful way, changes the course of Alzheimer's disease. So, you know, this has been the expectation of many, but hard to say that we were able to prove it with the conflicting data coming for aducanumab. So now we have the data for lecanemab on one hand and donanemab on the other. Lecanemab obviously got a provisional approval back in January, but that really didn't change anything in a meaningful way. What we needed was basically the FDA to take a hard look at the data, look at the clinical outcomes and the clinical relevance. And in fact, I'm also delighted that they brought in an AdCom. So they brought a group of outside experts to discuss the results and then give guidance to the FDA as to what they thought. And basically, there was a unanimous vote from the AdCom in favor of approval of lecanemab. Why is this important? Because there, you know, this is not a medication for everyone. It may change the course of the disease, but it doesn't stop the disease. It slows the progression. While people agree that there appears to be an impact on the course, some of my colleagues question the clinical relevance. They feel that the impact is modest and comes a pretty significant complexity. This is a humanized monoclonal antibody. They're basically all expensive, and in this situation, what adds to it is that it has to be given by intravenous infusion every 2 weeks. There is a tolerability concern, both in terms of mild to moderate infusion reactions that are seen in a quarter of patients that get the drug, and also what we call ARIA-E and ARIA-H. ARIA stands for amyloid-related imaging abnormalities, and the E for edema, and the H for hemorrhage. And what we're mostly looking at is what we often refer to as vasogenic edema, localized areas of swelling in the brain, and microhemorrhages. In most instances, these are clinically silent in about 75%, but in about a quarter, they're associated with clinical symptoms, that is ARIA-E and ARIA-H. And what are the clinical symptoms? Headaches, confusion, visual disturbances, gait disturbances, and we have to monitor carefully for that. In most instances, these are, you know, mild symptoms, in some instances, moderate, and in rare instances, they can be severe. What's the reason for this? We think that the reason is either that when the antibody comes into the bloodstream, mm-hmm. The first amyloid, fibrillary amyloid that it meets is actually not in the plaques on the brain, but it's fibrillar beta amyloid in the vessel walls, so the small arteries in the brain. Mm-hmm. And they actually sit on this side of the blood-brain barrier, so they're very accessible to the antibody. And that fibrillar beta amyloid, A-beta 42, is removed quite quickly. And there can be a temporary imbalance between removing the beta amyloid and the vessel sealing itself. There also appears to be actually a low-grade angiitis. That is that when the antibody binds to the beta amyloid fibrils there, it can generate an inflammatory response, which could also explain some of this seeping out. Okay. And if it is relatively low-grade, it will just be swelling. You know, it's just kind of, plasma that is pushed out. A little more, you might get a microhemorrhage. That's basically a pinhead-sized bleed. And in rare instances, you can have a larger bleed. You can have a smudge called the superficial siderosis, which is a small bleed right on the surface that kind of then spreads out. But macrohemorrhages are infrequent, but when they happen, they are serious. Mm-hmm. And in some instances, it appears that they have been associated with fatalities, with death. Mm-hmm. In addition, rare instances of seizures. So overall, ARIA-E and ARIA-H is seen in about 12.5% of participants. Like I said, most are clinically silent, just picked up on regular MRI monitoring, and most often seen within the first 3 to 6 months. So that's where you have the bulk of the monitoring to begin with, MRI monitoring. But you also need the clinical monitoring. And if somebody develops clinical symptoms, get an unscheduled MRI. This is not evenly distributed. The highest risk is actually with APOE4 homozygotes. Yep. The risk there for vasogenic edema, ARIA-E, is close to 50%. So that is something that is important to be aware of. And APOE4 heterozygotes, they have a much lower risk, mm-hmm. But maybe not quite as low as APOE3 carriers or 2-3 carriers. So this is one of the reasons that many clinicians and actually the outcome to the FDA seem to support that in order to have a good conversation with patients before they start, it might be important to know their APOE status. And if they are APOE4 homozygotes, to point out that their risk-reward balance might be different than other patients.
Lecanemab also met its secondary endpoints in CLARITY, the change in amyloid PET centiloids, and Alzheimer's Disease Assessment Scale Cognitive 14 scores relative to placebo over the 18-month study period. It also outperformed placebo on the Alzheimer's Disease Composite Scale and the Alzheimer's Disease Cooperative Study Activities of Daily Living scores. On both scales, it slowed progression by reported 24 and 37% respectively at the same time points. Lecanemab's safety profile shown in Clarity AD was similar to that's been previously observed, with ARIA-E occurring in 12.5% of patients treated. Symptomatic ARIA-E occurred at a rate of 2.8% in the lecanemab group compared with 0% in the placebo group. And furthermore, ARIA-H occurred at a rate of 17.3% in the lecanemab-treated individuals and 9% for those on placebo. Symptomatic ARIA-H was found in 1.4% of the lecanemab group and only 0.2% of the placebo group. While debate around the targeting of amyloid to modify disease has been ongoing for some time, one of the bigger aspects of the post-approval discussion around these amyloid targeting agents is their ability to possibly open the door to combination trials with agents targeting other key areas of dementia, such as tau. Ultimately, though, it speaks to the advances in the field over the last decade. Here's Dr. Thorstensen with more from his point of view.
So this really actually changes in so many ways. The whole practice around Alzheimer's disease. Some of it is really exciting because one thing is actually the drugs, but the progression in the past 5 years in fluid biomarkers, most meaningfully blood biomarkers, and no surprise, no coincidence that with the news about the FDA approval, we got numerous press releases from C2N, from Quanterix, from Quest, from Roche about their fluid biomarkers and the availability of fluid biomarkers. Because when you have treatments that target the underpinning of disease, you need to make sure that people have the pathology. And so we need biomarker verification. That's one of the first steps. We need to kind of be very thoughtful about the patients we select and that they're appropriate. And now we have to bring this into the clinic. And that's a different animal completely. It is a very small subgroup of patients that go into clinical trials. In general, they are healthier. There's less medical complexity, less concomitant medications. Although as a whole, the Clarity study of lecanemab had a more kind of real world population than most studies that I've been involved in. I think that's a good development, but still, this changes the way we do things. First of all, I'm really excited about maybe the availability of diagnostic biomarkers in the clinic for people that beyond those that want to go on lecanemab. And particularly if we can use blood biomarkers, we don't need to go for amyloid PET scans or spinal taps and CSF analysis. That is a huge step forward. And each year we basically are taking a giant step backwards. You often hear, "Oh, everything happens so slowly in Alzheimer's disease." Not true. The blood biomarker development has been really at warp speed.
However, despite progress, the base discussion about amyloid clearance and whether or not it provides benefit for patients remains top of mind for some amid all of this. Here's Espe with more of his perspective on how these amyloid treatments operate in this context.
So it turns out that some of the anti-amyloid treatments, lecanemab included, does something good. And that is not the reduction of amyloid, amyloid is doing nothing to our brains, is that it increases the fraction of the protein that's normal, the A beta 42, the amyloid beta 42, the 42 amino acid form of the protein. That's the protein that we all are losing when we develop Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. Lecanemab and a number of other medications in the past that have failed to meet that statistical threshold increase the levels of A beta 42. That would be a reason to give it if it weren't as toxic as it is. And it turns out that toxicity comes because removing amyloid serves no purpose. Mm-hmm. And it's not even a matter of, well, if we remove amyloid, but we also remove tau, then that would be good. No, it's not about removing anything from the brain. The brain is shrinking, and it's not shrinking because we have amyloid and tau. It's shrinking because the amyloid and tau responses to injury become insufficient. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing are the victims. Amyloid and tau are victims. They are not the villains. We're chasing the victims as if we were truly going after the perpetrators of the crime. We're not. We're going after the victims. So One thing that they do well, that some of them do enough of, is that it increases the levels of Aβ42. I've asked a company, Eisai, with Biogen, who have worked on the lecanemab, to look at their data and determine if, in fact, the ones that improved, if any, does, because in the whole data, nobody improves, it appears, but at least the people who do best with the treatment are those that manage to increase their levels of Aβ42 above a certain level of compensation. In our prior studies, we've demonstrated that there is a level above which, regardless of how much amyloid in the brain there is, people remain normal. And so that is quite important. Now, as I mentioned, is that does the end justify the means? The end of increasing the beta 42, the end justify the means of removing amyloid? I don't think it does. I think that we should just work toward increasing the normal fraction of the protein, which is invariably low, invariably low in everybody with dementia, rather than continue to chase amyloid, which is akin to killing the messenger.
But even those in favor of the drug's approval acknowledge that there are logistical challenges that can come along with this decision. While lecanemab's availability and CMS's willingness to provide coverage for it will likely be welcomed by patients and advocacy groups, it points to a clear need for understanding the role that these therapies can play in the clinic and effectively communicating that to the patients. Here's Dr. Thorstensen with more on that.
The clinical settings are not ready for this in any way, shape, or form, not by a mile. I can just look at my own institution. Mm-hmm. So there are more and more and more humanized monoclonal antibodies for all kinds of diseases. So keeping up with infusion capacity has been a continuous struggle, let alone with infusion capacity that is going to be dementia friendly. Mm-hmm. So there's limited infusion capacity. There's limited MRI bandwidth. There's certainly limited bandwidth for amyloid PET scans and for CSF fluid analysis. So I hope blood biomarkers can be a meaningful step forward here. You need to have people that know what they're doing. I really cannot overemphasize that. There's a difference between taking people that have been maybe working with humanized monoclonal antibodies. I've been doing that for 15 years with a whole team. We have a lot of time to kind of focus on each patient in clinical trials. So we need to build up a group of providers that understand this and that respect, the importance of doing this in a way where you dot the I's and cross the T's, that you set up a service where you carefully select patients that have early symptomatic Alzheimer's disease, that is biomarker verified, have relatively straightforward medical comorbidities, and definitely not overload on the vascular end, especially cerebrovascular end. You don't want to be taking people that have a lot of conjunctival amyloid angiopathy. You don't want to have, and how do you do that? You look for MRI findings. You look exclude people that have evidence of a numerous spontaneous microhemorrhages or hemosiderosis or bleeds. And so you then want to establish a careful clinical baseline. Again, like I said, biomarker verify that they've got elevated plaque burden. Start treating them, monitoring, especially in the first few infusions, that there are no infusion reactions, which are actually fairly easy to deal with. You can give NSAIDs and antihistamines, and you can pre-treat for maybe a few infusions, and then the system seems to kind of settle down. You need to monitor clinically for symptoms of azogenic edema, the headaches, the visual disturbances, the balance disturbances, sudden increased confusion. And if you see those, have a low threshold to get an extra MRI. And then you need to do the scheduled MRIs that are suggested after each visit. And you have to do it, because if there is vasogenic edema, you know, if it is very mild, you can treat through it. If it is either symptomatic in any way, or moderate severity or higher, you need to pause, you need to stop, and you need to observe this. And over the next, 12 weeks, the vast majority will, you know, have their, imaging findings disappear. And if there is, if it reverses itself, if there are multiple new microhemorrhages or larger bleeds or clinical symptoms that were concerning, you can start treatment again. But this requires attention. This requires focus. This requires somebody knowing what they should be looking for. It requires a team effort, because you need to basically have a neuroradiologist that knows how to read these MRI scans, that have to actually have special sequences that increase sensitivity for vasogenic edema and microhemorrhages. And so you want to make sure that they know that this MRI scan is for that, because they have to, you got to give them kind of heads up. Yeah. And you need to have an infusion center that knows what they're doing, and that preferably asks everyone before they get their IV cannula, have you had headache? Have you had visual disturbances? Have you had increased confusion or gait disturbance? The most common clinical symptoms before the next infusion is given. This is doable. But even if you do this in the best way, there are going to be rare instances that are likely to have bad outcomes. So it's important to be, upfront and honest with yourself, with your patient, and everyone else, that's the way it is. I think it is manageable. I think that it's important for me to be able to have that conversation with my patients. I think that if I had 100 people that were appropriate, mild or early symptomatic Alzheimer's disease, probably about 25% of those would have other medical issues or something going on that I would say, I probably, we shouldn't move forward. Yeah. And a lot of people don't want to do this. Why? Because they basically go, I'm too tied up. I don't want to do an infusion every 2 weeks. I've got an active life. I've got a lot going on. Some are going to be afraid of the side effects. There are all kinds of reasons why somebody might say, no, not for me. But at the end of it, so maybe half of that, the 75% that was left, says not for me. But the rest, 35% or so, a third of the people, are going to say, yeah, I'm interested in this. And then you have to work with them and explain to them what the process is, and that in each person's case, depending on their insurance coverage, they may have a meaningful out-of-pocket expenses in addition to, the risks that we spoke about before. So those are some of the things that I just want to highlight.
When Biogen's aducanumab was approved in 2021 via the accelerated approval pathway, many clinicians and institutions noted that they would not be utilizing the therapy in their clinics. With lecanemab's approval in 2023, it seems this hesitance remains to an extent. Regardless, though, of whether or not these amyloid-targeting monoclonals will be used widely, they certainly do not provide an immediate answer to the complexity that is Alzheimer's disease, as evidenced in part by the fact that those on both sides desire to explore combination treatments. In fact, there remains much to learn. Here's Espe with his thoughts.
These therapies are never going to work in the manner that we want them. We have to start moving away from finding anything that does something trivial. Mm-hmm. It's important to remember that 20 years after the last approval of any medication by the FDA for Alzheimer's, we are now 20 years later approving something that is half of the benefit than the last drug that we approved yielded. Mm-hmm. That drug, donepezil, has a magnitude of efficacy that's twice as big as lecanemab. So I think we have to, in the future, we just need to stop accepting peanuts. It is not okay to peddle the concept that anything is better than nothing. No, that is just an indictment that we have not, the fact that we cannot get our we cannot have a success. This is not a success. This is not a success. This is the illusion of success. We have to just move out of this concept. The collected data in humans suggests that amyloid forms in reaction to a variety of things the brain is exposed to. Some are toxic exposures, some are infectious exposures, some are biological derangements. That's what amyloid does. It reacts. That's why it's all over the brain. It's not all over the brain so that we would have our own toxin to deal with, as opposed to having to borrow a toxin from the environment. No, this is a reaction to something. People who have herpes simplex virus encephalitis, they get lots of amyloid in the brains. If they're cured, the amyloid goes away. If they aren't, partially they recover, but harmed, they're going to have something that looks like Alzheimer's, but is not because of it. That's the victim is because of the infection. The amyloid became a byproduct of that infection, a response to that infection. So we're in a weird period. I think this is so harmful that that we've accepted such puny outcomes. And companies are going to milk this one the best way they can. They're going to try to recover as much as they can, you know. And by the way, somebody like me, you would think my conflict of interest is will be very important for my hospital to give a lot of this out, because it'll be a financial windfall. Infusions are very, very profitable to hospital systems. So me saying we shouldn't give this to patients is not quite, this is against my conflict of interest. My conflict of interest should allow me to, or should open me to the idea that, oh, well, doesn't look that good, but heck, it's approved by the FDA, must be safe and effective. And it's neither. It's neither safe nor effective. This is what I call the illusion of progress.
As we mentioned earlier, the biggest point of contention around lecanemab surrounds the Clarity study's main finding. Similarly to the controversy that surrounded aducanumab's approval in 2021, there are still questions about the actual benefit of this class of medications overall. Donanemab, another still investigational member of this class from Eli Lilly, recently had data from the Phase 2 Trailblazer study presented at the Alzheimer's Association International Conference, which were published in JAMA, and has similarly struck up additional controversial discussion that has continued since the meetings occurred, mainly about the actual communication of the data to the public. Here's Espe with his perspective.
So the main endpoint is the IADRS, right? That's the activities of daily living. That's right. A pretty good endpoint. That's a 144-point scale. The lower, the worse. So the closer to zero, the worse off you are. Right. Patients were at 105, which is about mild dementia, MCI, at baseline. If you go from 105 to 100, that's good. That's a 5-point reduction, which is good. From 105 to 100, because I'm looking at the numbers, that would mean you're closer to zero. That's worse. That's the minimal worsening. Yep. That's detectable by patients. 5 points, just like in CDR-SB is 1 point, so on an 18-point scale. In an 144 scale is five. Five for the mild dementia, five for MCI, 9 for mild dementia. Mm-hmm. So 105 is the baseline. To 100, you would see a minimal worsening from 105 to 110, that would be minimal improvement, right? Okay. So people went from 105 to 99.5 in the donanemab and to 96.23 in the placebo. 602 in the donanemab and 9.27 in the placebo. They you subtract one from the other, that's a 3.25. 3.25 is below 5. So right there, speed is not going to be detectable by patients. And in the direction it's going, is in direction toward right, is all worsening. Again, same idea. It's not, nobody's getting better. Everybody's again is worsening, right? And so what did they say? They say it's 3-5% improvement because they divided 3.25 by 9.27, which is the difference in the placebo. But that's the between group difference that would mean no that's not the difference people are going to feel. The difference that people are going to feel is you have to use the same number, 3.25, and divide it by where patients in placebo end up in, which is 96.23. If you do that, then the true slowing of decline is 3.4%. 3.4%. This idea of using 35% for donanemab, 27%, if people think, oh, 27% improvement or 35% is amazing. Yep. If you say 35% benefit, that sounds amazing and it's so misleading.
Ultimately, though, as long as the therapy is safe to administer and access for patients is reasonable, there will be a demand for treatment and many will advocate for the approval, as is often the case for degenerative and neurological diseases. Additionally, this will undoubtedly not be the last time we hear about lecanemab. In fact, less than a week after the FDA granted it traditional approval, the Alzheimer's Clinical Trial Consortium announced a new study, AHEAD, that will assess the agent in 1,165 individuals with preclinical AD who have no cognitive symptoms present, using the preclinical Alzheimer Cognitive Composite 5 score and change in amyloid PET standard uptake value ratio over 216 weeks. Healthy skepticism and thorough peer review from the medical community has helped uphold proper scientific standards over the long haul. And certainly, studies of combination approaches will also be undertaken in Alzheimer, and more time will provide a better perspective on just how big or small these steps will be on the path to effective disease-modifying therapy for Alzheimer's disease. Perhaps these efforts, coupled with a demand from the advocacy community, will bear fruit for the patients with this disease. After all, that's certainly who all these stakeholders have in mind at the end of the day. Finally, here's Thorstensen with his outlook.
Some of my colleagues that have been hesitant about this are aware that there is going to be demand, and they're not going to, they've talked about the fact that a few of them have said, I treat my patients, and if they strongly request this, I will be honest about where I'm coming from, but I will oversee treatment. Others have said, in a situation like this, I would refer them to someone. Because of my own belief, I don't feel that I can give an unvarnished overview of the possibilities. So I'm going to establish connections with people that are more comfortable with this, and in these situations, maybe refer those patients temporarily or permanently to a trusted clinician that is willing to do this. And I've been around long enough. Many of the people that were hesitant here, especially around the aducanumab, are people that I highly respect. Yeah. And they're good doctors, they're good clinicians, they're good researchers. And sometimes you may not like what somebody has to say. You kind of like, no, I feel differently. Yeah. But hear them out, listen and see what is it that they're concerned about. At least have a voice in your head that says, I should probably be mindful of that. And I should be able to say to people, there's a range of opinion. Here is, my opinion, and I might be an optimist. And here is the opinion of one of my colleagues that is more negative on this. You need to know that there are different opinions, and that makes you informed about the state of things out there. So it's important to be aware of that. That most people felt that they had very good grounds for being cautious, particularly when we just had the conflicting data. So now, I see more that people are coming together and saying, okay, we've got 2.5 development programs, donanemab, lecanemab, and half of the phase 3 for aducanumab that suggested, a modest but kind of hard to disagree with benefit, and one that didn't. So I think that overall we're seeing people kind of settle in terms of the sense of controversy.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, you can visit neurologylive.com.